Welcome to session three of our series, The Audacity of Jesus, how Jesus defied convention and invites us to do the same. As a child growing up in the 80s, I, like many of you, was given a lot of freedom by my mom to roam the streets on my bike. Many of you can still hear your mother's voice, "Be back before dinner." And sure enough, I almost always came back before dinner. There's a name for that kind of parenting today. It's called free-range parenting. I kind of doubt that it was called that before, but with the rise of helicopter parenting in this generation, I suppose people looked back and decided they needed a name for it. There are a lot of opinions on how protective parents should be today, but nobody debates whether a parent should be protective. When our children are in danger, we need to step up. Most Christians also recognize that there are spiritual dangers out there too. In Mark chapter 9, verse 41, Jesus said, "If anyone causes one of these little ones, those who believe in me, to stumble, it would be better for them if a large millstone were hung around their neck and they were thrown into the sea." Jesus clarifies who he means by these little ones, anyone who believes. Why did he picture believers this way? The chances are Jesus saw just how vulnerable believers are to the deception of sin. He didn't mince words when talking about the consequences of one who caused them to stumble. But we struggle to do the same because our desire for harmony and our fear of conflict prevents us from calling out the wrong crowd. In our previous session, we explored how Jesus befriended outcasts, even if he was closest to those who shared in his mission. But there were people that he did not associate with at all. Even more than that, he provoked them. Who were the people that Jesus provoked, and how did he go about doing so? Well, let's take up the first question. Who were the people Jesus provoked? Based on our look at Jesus in session two, we know that Jesus wasn't interested in provoking your standard sinner just because they were a sinner. No one would have been off limits. And he graciously made space for them and invited them into his life. It might be tempting to say that Jesus targeted Pharisees and other Jewish groups that did not accept him. These groups regularly pushed Jesus for violating their religious sensibilities regarding cleanliness, eating, and activity on the Sabbath. We would call this legalism. In Mark 7:6, Jesus said, "You have let go of the commands of God and are holding on to human traditions." But even though the Pharisees became consistent opponents of Jesus, many invited him into their homes, and he often accepted their invitation. The Pharisee Nicodemus, who Jesus spoke with in John 3, defended Jesus in front of the other Pharisees in John 7:50, and brought myrrh and aloes to honor the body of Jesus in John 19:38. And Jesus would have lined up closer to the Pharisees theologically than many of the other Jewish sects. So even though Pharisees opposed Jesus, they were not categorically opposed to him. Certainly, Jesus called out a lot of hypocrites, which is another word for a pretender. Many of Jesus' opponents spoke religiously but lived a life inconsistent with the standards they promoted. But there's no reason why we should assume or classify hypocrisy as a higher form of sin. The ninth commandment, "You shall not bear false witness," was not more important than the rest. What was so special about hypocrisy? In Jesus' famous complaint against the teachers of the law and Pharisees, he consistently levies accusations of hypocrisy against them. But the heart of his complaint has to do with what their actions produce. Jesus says, "You travel over land and sea to win a single convert, and when you have succeeded, you make them twice as much a child of hell as you are." This is consistent with the warning we looked at in Mark chapter 9, verse 41. "If anyone causes one of these little ones, those who believe in me, to stumble, it would be better for them if a large millstone were hung around their neck and they were thrown into the sea." Jesus sometimes sternly challenges groups known for their legalism and hypocrisy, and yes, that included his own disciples on occasion, because their legalism and hypocrisy effectively taught others to do the same and misled people to sin. In other words, Jesus openly challenged false teachers, both false teachers who led people astray by their words and those who led people astray by their actions. This is why the Apostle John discouraged even welcoming someone who did not continue in the teaching of Christ. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not take them into your house or welcome them. Anyone who welcomes them shares in their wicked work. This is why the Apostle Paul encouraged disassociation from people who said they followed Christ but habitually practiced and embraced lifestyles of sin. They misrepresented Christ and led people astray in ways similar to some teachers and Pharisees, of whom Jesus said, "You must be careful to do everything that they tell you, but do not do what they do, for they do not practice what they preach." And this is why James writes, "Not many of you should become teachers, my fellow believers, because you know that we who teach will be judged more strictly." The sin of false teaching may not be different in kind to other sins, but it was different in effect. Jesus provoked false teachers on a regular basis to expose a trap and protect the people. How did Jesus do this? Consider Mark chapter 12, 13 through 17. In session 1, we explored how Jesus used questions to stir curiosity and teach. How does Jesus use questions to turn the tables on his opponents here? Mark chapter 12, verses 13 through 17 says, "Later they sent some of the Pharisees and the Herodians to Jesus to catch him in his words. They came to him and said, 'Teacher, we know that you are a man of integrity. You aren't swayed by others because you pay no attention to who they are. But you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. Is it right to pay the imperial tax to Caesar or not? Should we pay or shouldn't we?' But Jesus knew their hypocrisy. 'Why are you trying to trap me?' he asked. 'Bring me a denarius and let me look at it.' They brought the coin and he asked them, 'Whose image is this? And whose inscription?' 'Caesar's,' they replied. Then Jesus said to them, 'Give back to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's.' And they were amazed at him." Have you ever heard the expression, "The enemy of my enemy is my friend"? That's kind of what we have going on here. The Pharisees were nationalistic. They stood in opposition to the Roman occupation, even if they chose not to react violently to the rule as other Jews did. The Herodians, however, were supporters of King Herod, who served as a vassal of Rome. In this rare circumstance, they came together to trap Jesus. Roman taxation was a big part of the controversy. Part of it had to do with the coins themselves, which had the image of Caesar and a divine claim inscribed upon them. Both of these offended Jews. So they initially circulated their own copper coins without the image and statement. But the silver coin mentioned in this passage was required for Roman taxes and circulated throughout the land. Jews had to use it whether they liked it or not. In 6 AD, one Jew started a revolt over the taxes, calling his countrymen who did not support him cowards for putting up with the mortal masters in place of God. The Pharisees and the Herodians saw the tax question as an opportunity to force Jesus into the conflict and either put himself in opposition to the state or to the sensibilities of religious Jews. Jesus does not answer the question directly. He simply says, "Give back to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's." Jesus does not say give, but give back, which is a word used for debts. If Caesar is owed something, it should be given to him. Jesus never tells his listeners what that is. More importantly, Jesus never addresses when that is in conflict with what one owes God. And certainly there are times that that is the case, but he doesn't address those either. He may imply that both parties are due something, but he doesn't say it directly. He doesn't step into the conflict. But before answering the Pharisees and the Herodians, Jesus asks them to bring him a coin and identify whose name and inscription is on that coin. Jesus could have simply said, "I'm sure you have coins with Caesar's image and inscription on them." But instead, he lets the Herodians and the Pharisees implicate themselves by producing the coin in acknowledging that they are carrying coins offensive to Jewish sensibilities. In addition to that, Mark locates Jesus in the temple courts in Mark 11:27, which means that the idolatrous image they carried was in close proximity to the temple of God. By asking the question, he put them in the same position they were trying to put him in. Even worse, without being overtly adversarial, Jesus was able to openly challenge their sincerity with a simple question. Jesus used questions to indirectly challenge. Asking the question put his listeners in a position that caused others to take an honest look at his opponents. Showing can be so much more effective than telling. We find ourselves in similar positions too. Leaders, spouses, or parents might find themselves at the end of an exaggerated accusation. You never let me go out with my friends. Lots of people want to see this change. A good challenge question like, how many times? When was the last time? Or how many people can expose an exaggeration, invite people to consider their words more carefully, and help them to take personal ownership of their feelings on a matter? A challenge question can also expose a character flaw or a poor decision without accusing someone directly. How do you think that your wife felt about that? Or how would you feel in a similar situation? However, we can easily use challenge questions to escape our own responsibility, and Jesus never did that. When someone comes to us with a personal challenge and we played a part, the best thing to do is acknowledge it and say you're sorry. If the person is wrong, it can be better just to clarify. But if the accuser has wrong motives, that might be a good opportunity to indirectly expose an untruth. Not all of Jesus' responses to false teachers were as discreet, though, and here's where we enter some difficult terrain. Between Matthew 21:23 and Matthew chapter 24, Matthew records several moments seemingly in the same day that Jesus entered the temple courts and was tested by the Pharisees and teachers of the law. That time in the temple ends in Matthew 23 with a specific address to the Pharisees before the disciples and the crowds. Seven times Jesus says, "Woe," which is an expression of pain or displeasure regarding the actions of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. Six times he calls them hypocrites. Five times he calls them various forms of blind, blind men, blind guides, blind fools. He calls them snakes and a brood of vipers. And at one point he says, "You are like whitewashed tombs, which look beautiful on the outside, but on the inside are full of the bones of the dead and everything unclean. In the same way, on the outside you appear to people as righteous, but on the inside you are full of hypocrisy and wickedness." One of the most challenging names Jesus calls this group is blind fools, because in Matthew 5:22, Jesus seemingly warns against this. He says, "I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or a sister will be subject to judgment, and anyone who says, 'You fool,' will be in danger of the fire of hell." How can Jesus tell his disciples not to call a person a fool and use that same name for a group of people in a speech on hypocrisy, no less? It would be hard to make an exception for Jesus simply because of who he was, especially because the crux of his complaint against the Pharisees has to do with hypocrisy there. It would also be hard to make a case for a contradiction here, even if we looked at it purely from a secular point of view. Matthew could have easily removed the name or replaced it, and it's likely he would have if he had thought that his readers would have been confused. The key to understanding this likely has to do with the use of brothers in Matthew 5:22. The term brother is used 39 times in Matthew, and as one might expect, it simply refers to a biological sibling or siblings. But a good portion of those references refer to a person or people that one has a close affinity to. When Jesus uses it this way, he is not using it in reference to the brotherhood of mankind. He clearly uses it in ways that distinguish one group from another. The ESV of Matthew 5:47 reads, "And if you greet only your brothers, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same?" In Matthew 18:15, Jesus outlines a process for addressing a brother's wrong and encourages treating them like other groups if they do not respond to church discipline. But it's perhaps Matthew 12, verses 47 through 50 that distinguishes these groups the most. Someone told Jesus, "Your mother and your brothers are standing outside wanting to speak to you." He replied to him, "Who is my mother and who are my brothers?" Pointing to his disciples, he said, "Here are my mother and here are my brothers. For whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and sister and mother." Not everyone was Jesus' brother and sister. He directly challenged people that led others astray by their words and deeds in ways that he encouraged others never to use for a brother or sister because of the unique threat those people posed to the public. This may help us see through the apparent contradiction, but it doesn't resolve the tension this causes for us who live in polite society. Our series title is The Audacity of Jesus, How Jesus Defied Convention and Invites Us to Do the Same. The subtitle implies that if Jesus did it, we can and should too. It's an extension of what would Jesus do? But as are most things in life, this one is a bit more complicated than that. This was the way that all Jewish opponents talked about each other during Jesus' time. In fact, the approaches of ancient Jewish writers like Josephus and Philo tended to be worse. Perhaps it would be fair to say that Jesus' use of choice words to confront his opponents was more in keeping with the conventions of his time. But our culture is undeniably different from Jesus' culture, and that can change how we fulfill this expectation today. Frequently, we are commanded to greet one another with a holy kiss by Scripture, but very few people do that in America because kissing is associated with something else. Some Christians will abandon commands like these altogether, but it's better to find suitable replacements within our own cultures. Maybe that means that we greet one another with a sacred hug or a holy handshake instead. In the same matter, it's unwise to speak the same way Jesus did to his opponents because that's not considered a part of acceptable communication today. Jesus commanded us to be as shrewd as snakes and as innocent as doves in the midst of a hostile society. Relying on aggressive language may hurt us more than it will help in polite society, but there is still a place for a challenge question or for a firm response. If we simply ignore false teachers and pretend they are something they are not, we are ignoring all sorts of biblical expectations. I was invited to spend some time with a gentleman who had left the Jehovah's Witnesses, who deny the deity of Jesus, among other things. When I was spending time with him, the Witnesses kept coming back to him. Initially, I didn't want to encourage him to be confrontational, but he opened the door to them, and I started to see their influence start to creep back in. So I opened up the Scriptures to 2 John 10 through 11, which commands Christians not to welcome teachers who do not continue in the teachings of Christ. And he started closing the door to them. False teachers can't always be identified by their white shirts and black ties. They're all around us. And they don't just deceive people about lofty theological subjects like the Trinity. They are the ones who mislead us to sin by pretending that what's clearly black and white is gray. They teach us to minimize egregious social injustices while expressing outrage about things that don't matter. They misuse the Bible to encourage us to strive primarily for more comforts in this life while selling snake oil on TV. They cast shadows over difficult passages in Scripture, all to make them more palatable. And when their teachings go unchecked, they can lead the people we care about down a dark path. Our fear of confrontation can get in the way of saving someone's life. The Apostle Paul reminds us that our struggle is not against flesh and blood in Ephesians 6:12. Our struggle is against spiritual forces. But those forces influence and use people, and we need to be firm in those major truths that are clear and undeniable. Sometimes that might mean raising a question that exposes a dangerous false truth. Sometimes that might mean being more direct. But the people we care about could very well face the consequences if we fail to act.